Buddhism is one of the world's oldest religions, and Hillary is a longtime member of this fellowship, and she came to me last spring and asked if she could speak on Buddhism, and I was very excited because I'm so looking forward to hearing more about it. And so Hillary, without further ado, come on up.
That's scary. I'm going to start by saying that Buddhism is one of the world's largest religions. It started 2,500 years ago in what is now Nepal. I also want to say that although I have somewhat haphazardly practiced meditation, I have learned a lot by reading about Buddhism and preparing this talk. I had read the book on Buddhism, a concise introduction, but there's nothing like preparing a presentation to teach one more. We will now proceed with a story about early Buddhism. "Are you a god?" they asked. "No." "An angel?" "No." "A saint?" "No." "Then what are you?" Buddha answered, "I am awake." His answer became the title, his title, for this is what Buddha means. The Sanskrit root bud notes both to wake up and to know. Buddha means enlightened one or awakened one. While the rest of the world was wrapped in the womb of sleep, dreaming a dream known as the waking state of human life, one of their number roused himself. Buddhism begins with a man who shook off the daze, the doze, the dreamlike vagaries of ordinary awareness. It begins with a man who woke up. I'm quoting from the book on Buddhism by Houston Smith and Philip Novak, which I already showed you. And I assume they are quoting from another source. Now I'm going to jump ahead to the Buddha who decided to shave his head, wear tattered garments, and leave his family for 6 years to go into the forest. He subsequently moved to a schedule of preaching and counseling, which had its consequences. The foundations of the Buddhist path are the following: abstain from killing living beings, abstain from taking that which is not freely given, abstain from sexual misconduct, abstain from saying that which is not true, abstain from intoxicating drinks which lead to heedlessness. To summarize, he undertook to found a religion that had no God. It also had no authority. Number two, it was devoid of ritual. Number three, it didn't go into speculation. Number four, it was devoid of tradition. Number five, it required self-effort. And number six, it didn't have any aspects of the supernatural. So it didn't have any sort of God stuff, anything that we normally expect. And it was very Unitarian. It was, above all, and I'm going to say that Buddha was way ahead of his times. Number one, it was empirical. There has never been a religion that required direct validation. It was scientific, number two. It was scientific. It directed its attention to discovering natural cause and effect relationships that affected that experience. Number three, it was pragmatic. The Buddha kept his attention on issues that required solution. Number four, it was therapeutic. One thing that the Buddha teaches is there is suffering and there's an end to suffering. Number five, it was psychological. Note that we don't use the word metaphysical. The Buddha invariably began with the human condition, its problems, and how we go about coping with them. Number six, it was egalitarian. He described women as being as capable of enlightenment as men. Wow. At that time. He also rejected the caste system and all that it stood for. It was individuals. Number seven, the Buddha was completely aware of the social side of human nature. In fact, he founded a religious community, a sangha, which he hoped would encourage people to have spiritual friends. In fact, he said, noble friendship is the entire holy life. And I'm just saying that I belong to a sangha here in Regina. Now, the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, we are living in an ongoing state of dissatisfaction. The truth of the origin of suffering and dissatisfaction arise from causes and conditions. Number three, the truth of cessation. There's a possibility of reaching a state where that dissatisfaction or suffering have ceased. Number four, the truth of the path. There is a path for us to follow that will bring us to such a state. The Buddha had an analytical mind, which is why he made so many lists. Another list is upcoming. Rich or poor, average or gifted, all human beings experience the trauma of birth. We all understand how complicated birth is. The pathology of sickness, and we all know when somebody gets sick. The phobia of death, and we all are frightened of death. And the morbidity of decrepitude. We all know that old people are suffering. And to be tied to what one dislikes. We know that we don't like things, and to be separated from what one loves. Of course, that's obvious. Having said that, everything from the simplest gratifications to the greatest ecstasies is subject to the universal law of impermanence. And impermanence is a really critical word in this philosophy. As long as the human heart craves lasting satisfaction, impermanence assures dukkha, and dukkha is the word that we use for impermanence. Having said that, I will go on to a second point. It's not only the grasped-for world of experience that is impermanent. We, the graspers, are as well. The Buddha taught that we usually think of ourselves as an actually ever-changing product of five co-conditioning components, known in the Buddha's language as skandhas. They are body, sensation, perceptions, dispositional tendencies, and consciousness. The Eightfold Path is training for the path. What the Buddha proposed was a series of changes designed to release the individual from ignorance, unwitting impulse, and tanha, which is desire. It maps a complete course of training. Steep grades and dangerous curves are posted and rest areas indicated. By long and patient discipline, the Eightfold Path intends nothing less than to pick one up where one now is and set one down as a different human being, one who has been cured of crippling disabilities. Happiness he who seeks may win if he practice, so says the Buddha. Now the Eightfold Path is as follows. Right views. Until reason is satisfied, an individual cannot proceed in any direction wholeheartedly. In other words, we need to see where we're going. Right intent. Right intent advises us to make up our hearts as to what we really want, so that we need to think what we really want. Right speech. First, we must speak with truthfulness, and then we need to speak with charity. So, obviously, we need to speak charitably. Right conduct. We need to understand what is underlying our behavior. So we need to think about what we do. Right livelihood. We need to engage in occupations that are life-giving and life-aware. So we need to think about, again, what we are doing with our lives. Right effort. If we wish to reach our goal, we need to do so in a manner that is appropriate. And right mindfulness, our actions and thoughts are the result of what we do. Right concentration, one needs to focus one's mind on that which is our intention. So that sort of summarizes the Eightfold Path. So I'm open to discussion. David?
So you said you were part of the Sangha here in Regina. Can you mention a bit about what they do, for example, on a regular basis or on retreats? Because you just got back from a retreat a couple of weekends ago.
Yes, I belong to a Sangha in Regina. And normally we go on retreats on a regular basis. And we did go on a retreat recently. And it was a 2-day retreat, and we didn't stay in the place where we retreated, and it was quiet, and there were talks of what people needed to think about and to do. So that's basically what it was.
I was looking around for a copy of our Covenant of Healthy Relations, because I think in some ways it's very similar to the Eightfold Path. I'll do this. But I don't see a copy on the wall, so clearly one of us has to get that done. But it talks about many of the same things, about speaking with care and with kindness, and I'd like to see it in front of me because that works better. But anyway, I just can't help thinking it's very similar.
Thank you, Joanne.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether part of the 2-day get-together is a silent meditation, or is it all talks and discussion?
No, it includes silent meditation. And it's sort of segmented for talks and silent meditation. Yes. Thank you.
I understand there's more than one type of Buddhism, like there's Zen and another type. Am I understanding that correct? And what is the difference, if you know?
I don't know. there's Zen and Theravada and Vipassana and all kinds of things. There's all kinds of varieties of Buddhism, for sure. Yeah.
So in Buddhism, desire is one of the things you try to work with. So my impression of Buddhism is you kind of make a neutral mind. But then how do you do things without the desire? So say you want to learn painting. How do you learn to paint without the desire to paint? I'm probably interpreting it wrong, but that's why I was always curious about Buddhism, is how do you get to do it?
That's a good question.
I remember going to one of the day retreats and offered by the Vipassana group here, and it was quite good because they had a public public talk at near the end of the main thing. And one of the things that really got across to me was the idea of, there's an expression called wanting mind, and you know, we see this all the time, like in ourselves, we want to do something, to buy something, to visit something, to own something, to go somewhere, whatever it is, you know, and that can be fine, but it's when wanting mind becomes controls you versus you just recognizing it. And I think part of the way to become, well, I won't say enlightened, but I'll say more aware, is to be conscious of the things that are popping up in your head and just letting them come by and acknowledge them and not attach to them, because it's the attachment to ideas, the attachment to Donald Trump or something, the attachments people form, we all form, can enslave us to this sort of not aware condition, you know. So I think part of it is the awareness thing, and that's why awareness is always stressed so much. Awareness of what's going on in our heads, because that we want to experience things without a lot of our obsessions and you know, that kind of stuff.
Thank you, David. Thank you for mentioning that word attachment, because that's a critical word in Buddhism. Carol.
No, I was just wondering what drew you to Buddhism, to the practice. And like some people, like myself, like to read about it, learn about it, whatever, but we don't actually do anything about it. You did something about it. You became part of the shall we say, philosophy. And why was that?
I would like to say that I meditate on a regular basis, but I don't. I wish I would, and I would like to. Any other questions? Joanne?
Claire very kindly went downstairs and brought up not one, but two different versions of our covenant. So, trying to figure out where the heck the camera's gone. Oh, there it is. Anyway, just a very short summary. We have a covenant to create our vision of the world we aspire to live in, to contribute to an actively open and inclusive community, to help us support one another so that all might flourish. We value respect. We value trust. We value empathy. We value diversity. There's more, but those are the main headings.
Thank you, Joanne. That works, I think, with Buddhism.
Thank you, Hillary. I have learned a lot.